Hi, I'm Anne Strange Champs. It's to the best of our knowledge. And depending on where you live, winter can be tough to get through. It's cold, it gets dark early, the weather's messy. You can hop a plane to Florida or Phoenix or any place warm, or you can just turn up the heat and try not to get depressed. But animals, other animals that is, have winter survival tricks you would not believe. So maybe we should get some winter survival lessons from them. Today we're going to hang out with reindeer in Siberia and listen to walrus munch shrimp in the Arctic. We'll find out how frogs survive the entire season awake but frozen solid, and how bears convert nitrogen into protein while they sleep. Naturalist Bernd Heinrich tells Steve Paulson that animal winter survival is a marvel.
How animals survive freezing takes special tricks. The inside of the cells cannot be frozen unless there are special adaptations for that. So generally, they first of all freeze liquid component outside the cells, and that causes less damage. So they have to have mechanisms basically to withdraw water from the cells so that the freezing occurs outside and that the osmotic concentration inside the cells goes up to prevent freezing inside the cells.
So this is like a natural antifreeze. They get rid of all the water, or most of the water they have inside their bodies, but they instead somehow produce more sugar, more glucose or something, and that somehow protects them.
Yeah. You know, how glycerol protects membranes, we're not sure of. But, you know, for example, we can protect embryos of humans even, and cattle embryos are regularly shipped frozen. And they are stored in glycerol, which somehow protects the membranes. And so many of these frogs that survive freezing also produce glycerol. Now, glycerol actually has a couple of different functions. It acts as an antifreeze to lower the freezing point so as to prevent freezing. But when freezing does occur, it protects the membranes as well.
And I suppose for you as a scientist, if you come across one of these frozen frogs, your first reaction must be, oh, it's dead. I mean, it's frozen solid, but then you start to realize, oh, it's adapted this survival strategy.
Well, I certainly, if I hadn't known about this, if I'd have found a frozen frog in the woods and banged it on the piece of wood and gone clonk, 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 I would say, yeah, sure, that's a dead frog. By far the majority of animals or plants, if they're frozen, they're dead. You know, you put lettuce out and it freezes just a little bit and it turns to mush. So it is really amazing that they can survive that.
And then there are snapping turtles that will burrow into the bottom of a pond or a river for months at a time. And, I mean, the remarkable part of this story is the rest of the year they have to surface above the water to breathe air. I mean, they breathe oxygen with their lungs.
Yes, not just snapping turtles, but you know, a number of different aquatic turtles. Of course, they're air-breathing reptiles and they have lungs, and normally they breathe air. And in the summertime, most turtles are pretty good divers. They can stay down fairly long time. So winter survival basically under the ice involves a prolonged dive. But they have special adaptations that makes them able to have these dives very, very long. In part, it's due to the fact that due to the ice water, the metabolism is very, very low, first of all. And that would aid us for underwater survival, too. For example, people have crashed through the water in a car accident, and they go through the ice. If they are cooled quickly enough, they might be down there half an hour, and you pull them up, and they can revive. And the fact is that they get cooled so quickly that the metabolism goes down, and they're not requiring that much oxygen. So there's no oxygen depletion of the brain. And so it's no damage. Of course, turtles have a minuscule brain, and so they don't have that much to worry about.
What do mammals like beavers or muskrats do in the winter when their habitat, let's say a pond, becomes frozen solid?
Well, a beaver, of course, is locked in under the ice, same as a turtle, but it has a huge energy requirement. It keeps warm, so it has to breathe oxygen all the time. But, of course, it does that through its lodge, where it has an underwater entrance and air gets in through the top of the lodge, so it always has a place where it can breathe. Now the problem is the food supply, and it solves that by, in the fall, beavers get busy like beavers are supposed to and cut lots of brush and drag it into the water and have a huge brush pile, and they eat later on the bark. So they harvest the brush in the fall when the water is cold so that the bark stays nice and fresh. And so then whenever they get hungry, they can just dive out of the hole in the lodge and go underwater and grab a twig and come up and eat it in the lodge.
But the muskrat is probably somewhat different. I mean, they don't actually have big lodges like beavers do.
Well, muskrats have small lodges, and they can also come up for air, but they don't make a large food store, so they actually have to forage under the water and look for roots and pond lilies and so on. So their survival places more reliance on being able to swim for a long time underwater. And they actually, come winter, have more myoglobin in their muscles, which allows them to become better divers so they can stay under longer.
Don't they get very cold when they're swimming around in that water?
That's a major problem. Of course, you know, beavers and muskrats have famous pelts with guard hairs to keep away the water and insulating under fur that holds a layer of air to insulate them. But even then they have, you know, their feet get cold and the ears. And so there they have special circulatory mechanisms for allowing blood circulation while retaining the heat in the body called countercurrent heat exchangers. But they also have only a limited amount of time no matter what. And they basically heat up a little bit extra before they take a dive, which allows them to stay a little bit longer before they get cold.
Now, I'm guessing one of the most remarkable adaptations for the winter is what the black bear does during hibernation. You write about how bears may hibernate for up to 5 months, but they don't actually drink anything or urinate during that whole time.
No, they don't eat and drink or urinate, defecate, and so they've got an ideal situation where they're sleeping all winter long, but they maintain a high body temperature.
One of the ways that humans survive is by urinating. I mean, one of the reasons why we have to drink is that forces us to urinate,
exactly.
And it flushes out
right.
The toxins. And if we didn't do that,
right.
We would die.
Right. First of all, the main toxins are the product of nitrogen metabolism, which we get mostly from eating proteins. The bear relies mostly on fat for its energy, and that would release very little nitrogen and hence much less toxins. And those nitrogen products that it does produce, instead of excreting it into urea, which has to be flushed out through the kidney with lots of water and urine, it converts this nitrogen back into protein. So this has a double purpose of saving water and preventing degeneration of the muscles. For example, we would start to metabolize our muscles and we would lose muscle tone and become weak. The bear gets up in the spring and runs up the mountain and is just as much in shape at the end of the winter as at the beginning.
And that's amazing when you think about it, that a bear could essentially be sleeping for 5 months and then one day gets up and goes wandering off without any loss of muscle tone or of bone mass.
Yeah, the bone mass too. We would have osteoporosis and brittle bones. They're definitely extremely interesting animals, and NASA has been interested in them for obvious reasons. For anybody who wants to be out in space and weightless and without exercise for a very long time. So there are lots of medical marvels out there.
Bernd Heinrich is a naturalist who's written a lot of books. Steve Paulson was talking with him about Winter World, the ingenuity of animal survival. So knowing something about how animals survive winter is a good thing, but this is radio. How do animals sound in the winter? For that, let's turn to Douglas Quinn. He's an award-winning sound designer and composer, and we're going to hear a bit from his album called Fathom, underwater field recordings from the polar regions of the Earth. So, Doug, what are we hearing here?
The sounds that you're hearing are recorded underwater using a hydrophone, an underwater microphone, in Bristol Bay in Alaska. And what we're hearing are the gonging sounds and teeth clacking from walruses. These are males generally displaying. And the display has a visual component in the surface, but they dive and they make these beautiful, resonant, full gonging sounds, and this wind-up that you hear with the teeth clacking. They're not...
So that's teeth? I keep wondering, what is that tapping, banging sound? That's their teeth?
Yeah, they're a whole percussion ensemble. To me, it's sort of almost like gamelan in the range of sound that we hear. And you can hear definite sort of percussive phrasing, particularly in the teeth clacking as they ramp up and reach a crescendo and stop. And it's a very, very, very powerful sound. And these are many, many walruses recorded near Round Island, a walrus sanctuary off the coast of Alaska.
So how did you capture this sound? What did you have to do to record it?
I was there for a week, and they had all taken off from their haul out on the rocky beaches of Round Island. And just one evening, about 11 o'clock, we could see them coming back, and so got into a Zodiac inflatable boat and headed out with a hydrophone in hand and just lowered it about 30 feet and listened.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to think what a rich world there is under the ice. There's another incredible set of sounds that you recorded of Weddell seals kind of calling to each other.
Yes, this is, I think, one of, I consider this a gift in a way, the both the quality of the sound and for sheer musicality. I was really stunned. And I think one of the interesting aspects of sound with the recordings of the Weddell seals is that my first introduction to them sonically was listening to their calls and very powerful chug sounds. They have a wide vocabulary of sounds to draw from. More than 40 calls have been identified. And you can feel it through 8 feet of ice in your bunny boots. So feeling that power, I mean, the decibels are 180 decibels, some of the signal levels, which think of a very loud rock concert and then some.
Sound quite biological, do they? Doesn't it sound like something you'd imagine hearing in outer space?
Exactly. They're so evocative of things we've come to know through music or, outer space. When I first heard it, I thought of classic electronic music from Karlheinz Stockhausen in the 50s, old analog electronic music, and the richness of these tones. I often tell people, for all the computers and synthesizers we have, somehow I'm never quite prepared for what I hear in the natural world.
You know, I always somehow thought it would be pretty desolate in Antarctica, and yet, you know, you found these rich sounds, many of them recorded actually under the ice, but there are also some recordings you made just of the ice itself, which I guess somehow it hadn't occurred to me that ice itself would make noise.
That was one of the joys in dice. People say, well, what are you going there? There's nothing there. But on the contrary, it's teeming with life along the coastline and along the sea ice edge, which is where I spent most of my time. The recording that you're listening to here has a lot of noise, or what appears to be static, and you have to think of millions and millions, if not billions, of bubbles from brash ice floating around the surface as that melts. Think of ice in a glass melting and multiply that. Then you're hearing the groaning of icebergs as they either turtle or flip over or rub up against each other. So all range of sound from sort of pitched material, again, the groaning, to these explosions when they break apart, and then the brash ice percolating away.
You know, I think one of the great gifts of listening to some of your recordings is it really hits you so powerfully that the world is alive. I mean, it's hard to think of that as an inanimate thing making that kind of roaring, groaning noise.
Yes, it is that you realize when you take the time to listen, which almost seems a luxury in our fast-paced lives, that everything is in constant motion around us. The air and sound is around us all the time in varying degrees, some of it very subtle and some of it extraordinarily powerful, from glaciers to wind to volcanic eruptions to the delicate sounds of birds and insects. So I think the world is always alive. We can never turn it off or tune it out, really.
Douglas Quinn is an award-winning sound designer and composer, and we were talking about his album Fathom, underwater field recordings from the polar regions of the Earth. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about winter survival and what we could maybe learn from animals about how to get through the cold and the dark. Piers Vitebsky is an anthropologist who studies the Evenyi, or reindeer people, of Siberia. They not only depend on the reindeer for their physical survival, they keep herds of them for meat, but also for a spiritual connection. Vitebsky tells Steve Paulson that the Evenyi have personal, consecrated reindeer animal doubles, which they believe will die for them.
Originally, when the reindeer were first domesticated, or no, let's go back before that, wild reindeer, which are the same as what you call caribou in North America, they migrate spontaneously huge distances. And what prehistoric hunters must have done is they must have ambushed them at certain points on their cycle where it was easy to catch them, say at a river crossing or something like this. But in Asia, they domesticated them 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and that means that instead of just lying in wait for a wild herd, you can actually follow them. So humans became rivals for the wolf at that point. They were in competition to follow and predate the herds. And gradually, actually only in the last 400 or 500 years, they started keeping larger herds and using them for meat.
So they're both domesticating the herds to use for transportation, but they are also hunting the reindeer as well?
Yes, the transportation came first, and that was largely in order to hunt. So what is new, just really since the expansion of European colonialism, is the keeping of large herds for meat. So what you have today is two different kinds of animal within each herd and each community. There's the kind of mass herd, which is kept for meat and for breeding and just to reproduce the herd endlessly. And then there are reindeer that are specially selected because of their personal qualities, their characteristics, to train for riding, for pulling sledges. The female ones are used for milking. And these reindeer develop a very close personal relationship with their keepers. They have their names, they answer to their names. They don't always need to be lassoed in order to bring them to you. You keep them coming to you each day. Even if you're not going to ride your reindeer, you have to hold out some salt on the palm of your hand, caress it, speak its name, so that it will remain domestic and remain close to you.
You're describing a relationship that we might almost describe as a pet.
Almost, in a way, yes. The way they see the reindeer is that these close, intimate domestic reindeer also have attached themselves to us, and there's a legend about the origin of the first domestication, which is that an old man was walking through the forest one day at the beginning of time, and in a crack, in a cleft in a larch tree, he saw the head of a baby reindeer calf peering out. And this was the first reindeer that ever came into being. It was born out of a larch tree, but it was stuck. It couldn't get out. So the old man acted like a midwife. He actually helped the reindeer to come out of this larch tree. And something similar must have happened somewhere else with another reindeer, because later on this calf grew up and it mated with this other reindeer and they had their own children. So this was the beginning of the race of reindeer. And one day wolves attacked this family and the parents ran away. They abandoned their children and ran away. But the young calves used their sharp antlers and impaled the wolves and killed them. So the creator god in the sky came down and he scolded the parents. He said, how could you abandon your children in their time of need? And the parents said, well, we can't cope with these wolves. So the god said, well, what do you want to do about it in future? And they said, well, when we were being born, humans were very kind to us, so we would like to live forever in association with humans and under the protection of humans. And in return, we'll give them our labour, we'll give them our meat, but at least they'll protect us from wolves. So those were the ancestors of the first domestic reindeer. And then this god turned to the calves and said, well, what do you want to do? And they said, we don't want to give up our freedom at any price. Even if we have to cope with wolves, we don't want to be subordinate to humans. So they went off in the opposite direction and became wild reindeer.
Can you describe the relationship that these reindeer people have with the animals that they hunt and that they live with, and the role that spirits play in their lives?
I suppose, firstly, if you try to ask yourself, what is a spirit? The idea is, I think, that the world of phenomena that we see around us is only the surface of things, and that there is a further reality behind the surface appearance. And this reality really consists in the essence of these phenomena. So if we say, well, what is it that makes a reindeer into a reindeer, or a bear into a bear? It's the soul or the spirit of this creature. Even of rivers and mountains, if you think that they have souls or spirits that are similar to the kind of consciousness that we have, then it means they have their own consciousness, and therefore they have their own agendas too, which means that these spirits are also the causes of things that happen in our lives. So Bayanai, for example, the spirit master of the animals. Animals breed under his control, they move about under his control. He is the principle of wild animality, you could say. So everybody depends on wild animals to stay alive. You need to eat the meat. So how do you catch an animal? Well, it's not that you chase the animal and corner it against its will, which is how white people might see it. They say that the animal gives itself to the hunter of its own free will at the behest of Bayanai. So Bayanai controls the rations, so to speak.
So do people make offerings to Bayanai, or are there certain people who can communicate with the nature spirits, or can everyone do that?
Everyone can in principle, but a good hunter is somebody who has a good relationship with Bayanai. So when you kill an animal, you must respect the animal's body. You must do certain things to it. For example, you should lay the head facing east so that the animal's soul will rise again like the rising sun. And what that means is that it will be reincarnated in the future. And when you meet its next incarnation, it will remember you. It will say, this was the hunter who treated me properly last time. And then it will give itself to you again.
Do the reindeer figure at all into the way people think about death?
Yes, very much. I think because people see reindeer as a substitute or an analogy for themselves. So, for example, some reindeer that are trained for riding and for sledge pulling become very intimate companions. They have their own names and their own personalities. And within those, very often, a person will have a consecrated personal reindeer, which is like an animal double. This animal has to be very carefully looked after. It's exempted from a lot of hard work because it really is you as well. The moment when this really emerges clearly is if you're in some kind of danger from the landscape, from some attack of evil spirits or a bear or something, you may not even know what the danger is, but your consecrated personal reindeer double will die. And at that point, you know that it has deliberately offered itself as a substitute for you. You have to consecrate another one, of course, to maintain the same level of life insurance. So in the course of a lifetime, you can get through several of these consecrated deer. There are lots of stories and lots of connections people make between a reindeer, a personal reindeer double that dies, and some terrible danger that you are saved from. So we could say that that's a consequence or an implication of domestication that a reindeer can actually choose voluntarily to offer itself as a sacrifice.
Can the reindeer people of Siberia survive? Is this a viable way of life for years to come?
I think the answer is yes and no. There are two kinds of economy in the North, and this is largely true in the American North too, but especially in Siberia. There's the white man's economy, which is based on minerals, mining, oil and gas, and so on. And on the whole, natives are not involved in this very much at all. And then there's the native economy, which is based entirely on animals, hunting and reindeer herding. So for the natives, there's not really anything else that can be done on that landscape. If they weren't there, that landscape would be totally uninhabited, hundreds, thousands of miles at a stretch. The landscape represents an opportunity, and somebody is going to stay behind and fill that niche. So in the communities I know, you can see different people are looking in different directions. Some people say, well, even if the state withers away, even if all the infrastructure, all the helicopters, we never see them again, we can go back to the land, we can just live a subsistence hunting existence the way our ancestors did in prehistoric times. So that's certain kinds of people, though they would have a minimum requirement, certainly for ammunition. And then there are other kinds of people, especially younger people who've spent their entire lives in boarding schools and in the village, who couldn't possibly survive in that way. So they're looking more towards the city. So if the state farm completely collapses, if the villages become uninhabited, then those people, I would imagine, would emigrate to the city.
Piers Vitebsky talking about his book, The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. Steve Paulson talked with him. Writer Kim Hiss discovered her own symbiotic relationship with animals in winter. She was working as an editor for Field and Stream magazine, and it was her first hunt.
I was an editor at Field and Stream, but I was in a very administrative role. And an invitation to a hunt came along through Field and Stream. It was a women's hunt offered by the NRA. They had asked the then editor of the magazine, Sid Evans, if he had a woman on staff who would like to try hunting, and he asked me if I wanted to go. And I was real wide-eyed at the time and said, let me think about it. I mean, I was up for it, but I needed to give it some thought because this is a big step.
So this wasn't a no-brainer, like, oh, I'd love to go shoot something.
Not a no-brainer in any sense. I'm a big outdoors person. I love sailing with my father. I'm a big hiker. I'm a big backpacker. So the outdoors component of it, that was a no-brainer. But when you're sailing or you're backpacking, you're having a great experience. But when you're hunting, that experience is happening at the expense of a life. And that's a big responsibility. And that was something that I did not take lightly. What I basically came down to was that I'm a meat eater. I eat meat. I have all my life. But at the time, I had never taken responsibility for what was on my plate. I would go to the grocery store, I'd get something out of the meat department, take it home and eat it. I mean, there was no connection to where that came from whatsoever. And I thought, okay, this is an opportunity, if I'm going to be eating it anyway, which I always have, to acknowledge my place in the food chain. I've never killed anything before. Bambi was my favorite movie as a kid. I mean, my family was shocked I was going hunting at all. Basically, the entire experience was very out of character for me.
Were you afraid you'd freak out at the sight of blood or afraid that you just would see a deer but not be able to actually take a shot?
You know, it was everything. I was afraid I'd see a deer and freeze, not be able to take a shot. I was afraid I would take a shot, but I'd freak out. It would be a bad shot, and then I'd wound something that I then wouldn't be able to recover and basically cause suffering. I was very nervous because I just didn't know what to expect.
So what happened when you finally saw a deer?
It was late morning. We basically, this is my guide and I, spotted a group of deer at the top of a hill. So my guide had me get into position, and there were two bucks in that group, and he helped me decide which one made the most sense. As I remember it, the group had kind of bolted and then stopped, so I basically had a very quick second if I was going to take the shot to do so, and I did. That was a 245-yard shot.
So that's a pretty long way.
It was a very long way. But I felt that I had scoped it in well, and I felt confident in the moment that I could take the shot, so I did. So that basically stopped the deer enough for me to run up the hill and take a second 170-yard shot, which dropped the deer in its tracks. And it was over that quickly. Once I got to the deer, saw that it was down, saw that there had been, if any suffering, it was extremely short because the shot was extremely clean. I was relieved that it had, I don't want to say worked out, because clearly it didn't for the deer. I mean, you are taking a life. It's a responsibility, but it had happened as cleanly as it could have.
Did you feel bad about what you had done, or did you feel like this was great, I'd like to do it again?
I had a very mixed reaction to it, which was very much at odds with the reaction my guide had. My reaction was very sober. Once I got to the deer, we knew that it was dead. Again, there was this feeling of relief, but there definitely was sadness mixed in. I did cry a little. I kind of cradled the deer. It was a very odd reaction from me. I was really trying to come to terms with it. So it was kind of a somber moment of relief mixed with regret, mixed with, clearly it's a difficult feeling to describe.
How did your guide react?
Well, that's the thing. The guide, on the other hand, is very used to experiencing in his clients that kind of rush, adrenaline pumping reaction that some hunters do experience. So he pulled a truck around, slipped in a CD, and cranked up Queen's Another One Bites the Dust and started cranking stadium rock for what he assumed for me was this moment of, you know, adrenaline, triumph. But he was really expecting one reaction from me, and I had one that was positive, negative, regretful, a little pride mixed in, a little relief mixed in. There was a lot going on at the time.
Have you gone hunting since?
I have, many times. I think my first hunt after that, it was for duck in Oregon, which was a very different experience, and one that I'm not sure I enjoyed quite as much. In a duck hunt, you're using a shotgun, you're in a floating blind, and if a flock comes in, you shoot at the flock. In this case, a dog was running out into the water to retrieve the ducks and bring them back. And while I did enjoy being outside, I did like the process of getting the ducks and then bringing them home back to New York and having a big dinner with the ducks, with my friends and my family. And I enjoyed knowing where that meat had come from. Because you were shooting into a flock, I felt like it was easy to kind of disconnect from what you were doing.
Not as individual as looking at a single deer.
It was not as personal and intimate as an experience as the single deer had been.
You said one of the reasons you initially went hunting was you thought, well, you're a meat eater and, you know, you should have some experience of what it means to be willing to kill what you're going to eat. Have you found that hunting has changed your experience of eating?
I have. And I can say two things. The first is that there's a lot of meat in a deer. While my boyfriend and I initially were trying to make our way through all the deer meat in the freezer and very, you know, nicely make dinners of venison steaks with some amount of reverence for what we were eating that evening. We would always make an event out of eating the deer that night. In order to get through all that meat, we had to invite friends over for dinner, which was great. It kind of spun into a tradition where every time I got an animal, we would have a game dinner with all our friends, which was fantastic. So I do enjoy knowing where that meat came from and being able to share it with people I love and having them, even if they don't agree with hunting, appreciate the perspective of where this meat came from and kind of appreciate the eye-opener that I've experienced as well. If I do end up buying meat from the store, hunting hasn't changed my buying habits, but it does change the way that I eat meat from Stop and Shop or from Superfresh. I really took, you know, the turkey on my plate for dinner or the chicken in my sandwich for lunch out of context. There was no context for it. It just was there. I didn't think about it. As opposed to the ducks in Oregon, where I shot a duck, it falls to the water. A dog brings that duck to me. I put it in a cooler. I bring it back to New York, put it in my freezer, put it in a pan, and it ends up on the plates of myself and my friends. I know where that meat came from. And I think that's important to keep in touch with and not lose sight of.
Do you think your experience as a hunter, even a first-time hunter, was any different because you're a woman?
I'm not sure. I know some people say yes, some people say no. I had a very kind of tender, somber reaction to killing the deer, which I, you know, would think if you're going to subscribe to stereotypes, that would be a more female reaction. But on the other hand, I have talked to male hunters who, after a kill, don't take a photo of it, as many hunters do, because certain male hunters think, you know what, this is not the time for pictures. I just killed something. I'm going to field dress it and take it home and get it in the freezer. So I don't know. I don't know how much my reaction had to do with gender and how much it had to do with just my own disposition.
Well, I know this is something you think about, you know, women and hunting, gender and
certainly.
Hunting. I'm just curious, you know, is it just that hunting isn't something women have done a lot culturally, and so when they do step into the field and pick up a gun, they are going to be more thoughtful about it. There's going to be this sort of faint feeling that they're crossing a boundary. Or is there really something intrinsically, you know, innately gender-based about women's reactions to hunting?
Public perception tends to be more surprised to see a woman in the field than a man. I mean, there's really no way around that. It is a more arresting visual image, definitely, to see, you know, a female in the field with a rifle and a dead moose or a caribou. I mean, it certainly does go against that Bubba hunter stereotype that a lot of people are used to. It's interesting that historically that has not always been the case. 100 years ago, women were arguably more of a presence in the field and for whatever reason kind of dropped out, only to come back recently.
There were more women 100 years ago hunting?
Throughout the 20th century, there seems to have been a sort of relatively strong presence of women in the field, which seemed to have dropped off mid-century and now seems to be coming back. And this comeback is what a lot of people pick up on as seeing a surge in women hunters. But if you look back at the 1890s, you see a lot of women in the field. If you look in the pages of Field and Stream, women are a very strong presence to the point at which they're on the cover. There's a women's department. So around the 1890s, turn of the century, women were certainly a healthy presence in the field. It's really interesting to go back through those old dusty magazine archives and see a bunch of skirts in the pages of Field and Stream.
It's really interesting thinking about that 100 years ago, people didn't perceive a woman who hunted as the anomaly that we do today. Because I think, you know, today there's something that probably seems culturally a little off about the idea of a woman, say, putting down her nursing infant and going out to shoot a brace of rabbits.
Another part of that I can say is that I have met a number of women who do hunt while they're pregnant, which is a very interesting image and a very interesting meeting of a role of creation and destruction. And it's that's a whole other topic that I think obviously a man can experience, but a woman bringing a pregnancy into her field experience is very interesting to talk about.
What do the women say?
They say a whole bunch of interesting things. I've talked to women who sit in a deer blind and say that they don't feel their baby kick any other time more than when they're sitting and relaxed in their blind. It's when the mother says she's the most relaxed and she's the most self-aware, and that's when she feels the most activity from her baby, which is very interesting. Another common thing that I've heard from them is that they're excited to be initiating their child into this tradition of hunting, even in the womb, and they can't wait to take their kid hunting when they're old enough to do so. So there's a very strong traditional element in there as well.
Kim Hiss is a former associate editor for Field and Stream magazine. Coming up, writer Helen McDonald shares a favorite winter read and the Dutch Christmas tradition that has thousands of adults dressing up in blackface and Afro wigs every year. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hello, my name's Helen McDonald. I'm the author of H is for Hawk, and I want to recommend a 1973 children's book called The Dark is Rising by the author Susan Cooper. This funny thing happens in England every year. A whole bunch of friends of mine on the winter solstice, we all read this book. It's a book about magic. You know, anyone who's read Harry Potter will know that there is a long history of books about small boys when they're about 10 or 11, realizing that they're not normal, that they have magical powers. And this is one of the early books in that kind of tradition. And it's about a small boy called Will, who wakes up on his 11th birthday to discover that he is, in fact, one of the old ones. And his job is to protect the world against the forces of darkness. This all sounds very, very cliched, but my goodness, I cannot recommend this book more highly. It's one of the most beautifully written fantasy books I've ever come across. It made the English landscape sing for me as a child. It's full of snowy woods, it's full of Arthurian legend, it's full of Anglo-Saxon myths, it's full of everyday life. There are the most astonishing sequences which brim with eerie power of, you know, the small boy who has the power to light fires out of dead wood he sees lying on paths, and the panic as he realizes that for some reason he cannot put them out. You know, when you're small, you're prey to fears, you're prey to panics in a way that I think disappear as you get older. And whenever I read this book, those old kind of panics about our place in the world and the limits of our powers come back bright as ever. And it's also a very poignant book. There are characters in here who suffer, there are characters who are caught out of time, and the whole thing is also about how we see the past in the landscape. And this has been very influential for me. You know, when you look at the landscape, wherever you are in the world, it's very fascinating to try and imagine who stood there before you. And this book plays with that sense and plays with the stories we've told about the places we live. And also it's got kind of really cool things that you find in fantasy books. You know, Will has to collect a series of very important things of power. Again, very Potter-like. And the whole book itself is part of a much wider series that deals with this great fight between the dark and the light. You know, you can't mess around with that, you know, as a topic. So I really recommend you go out and buy this book, and I really hope you'll love it as much as I do.
Helen MacDonald recommends The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with MacDonald on our website at ttbook.org. To say that Santa Claus is a big deal during Christmas time in the U.S. is an understatement. At least for the next couple of weeks, Santa rules. But there's a guy in the Netherlands giving Santa Claus a run for his money. His name is Black Pete. He brings presents and candy to children, which means that every year, all over the Netherlands, grown-ups dress up as Black Pete by putting on blackface, an afro wig, bright red lipstick, and big hoop earrings. Roger Ross Williams is an Academy Award-winning American filmmaker. He had never heard of Black Pete until he married a Dutch man and moved to Amsterdam just before Christmas. So what do you do when you're an African-American filmmaker living in a country full of people who dress up in blackface at Christmas time? You pick up a camera. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with Williams to talk about his documentary, Blackface.
Well, the first time I saw Black Pete, I got this sort of gut-wrenching, horrible feeling right in my gut. Like, it was like, it's frightening, you know, being a Black person to see someone who looks at your skin and your hair as a costume. Mm-hmm. And I was like shaking and just totally freaked out by it. You know, I think any person from outside of from the U.S. especially is, you know, sort of freaked out when they see Black Pete. But I think if you're for a Black person, it's even more sort of, it's painful.
Painful. Now, you are a famous filmmaker and your pain, you took it somewhere. You picked up the camera and you made a movie and you walk around and you talk to Dutch people about Black Pete. What'd you learn?
I learned that Black Pete is sort of a leftover rooted in slavery, the character. The character came out of around the 1850s, a book called Santa Claus and His Slaves. It's a figure that around, you know, sort of at the time when slavery was ending, it was a way to dehumanize a race. It was a way for white Europeans to feel superior to non-white people of the world. And Black Pete, it's an obvious racist figure, but it's also rooted in this time where slavery still continued to 1863 in the Netherlands, not in the Netherlands, but in the colonies in the Netherlands, in Suriname and Curaçao. they held on to it. And, you know, the Dutch made their money by trading slaves. So the West India Company was a big multinational, one of the first multinationals in the world, and they made their fortune trading slaves from Africa. So this figure has a deep history and a very dark history.
I lived in the Netherlands in a small town and also in Amsterdam for many years. And I will say the Dutch people are not dumb. They're very environmentally aware. They're aware of their own legacy with colonialism. They're pretty progressive on a lot of issues. They're still donning blackface. Why?
They're still donning blackface. Well, the Dutch children do not learn about their colonial history in school, actually. Mm. The Dutch sort of like to cover up their dark past. They learn about the Holocaust, but they don't learn about their role they played in the slave trade. And I think that that's one of the reasons why they don't connect Black Pete to slavery. They say, this is history, this is a fun, lovable character. I don't know how you could put on blackface and say it has no connection to Black people. Or
yeah,
slavery,
man, but that seems pretty obvious to me.
But they do it.
Yeah.
And they will, I mean, they will argue. I mean, I was stopped in the dog run by a woman. I was walking my dog and she said, she's like, I will die for Black Pete. Black Pete makes me Dutch. I think they identify Black Pete with their national heritage. So it's something that they believe is Dutch, and they're holding on to that as, you know, the world becomes more sort of global, and they're holding on to that thing because that they feel that Black Pete is what makes them Dutch.
You know, one of the things that really, I mean, it shouldn't shock me, I don't want to use that word, I don't want to seem naive, but one of the things that I thought was powerful in the film is the prime minister. You have the prime minister. What does the prime minister say about it?
You know, so the prime minister was asked what was his position on this issue, and he said, you know, that he actually takes him a couple days to get the black paint off of his face, and that, you know, luckily his black friends in Curacao and Suriname, you know, they don't have to wash the black paint off their face because they're already black. And I said, not even Donald Trump would go and dare to go in blackface. And here you have a prime minister of a country and he's supposed to represent all the people, black and white, who live in that country. And he chooses to dehumanize an entire race of people, of his own citizens. It's shocking to me.
And I will add, not all the citizens, but the Dutch colonialized Suriname and Curacao, where people are black from those parts of the world. I have very close friends from those countries. Yeah. That wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago, and Suriname this year outlawed Black Pete. Passed the law last year, and it was just enforced this year, so you're actually not allowed to go as blackface in Suriname. The majority of black people are adamantly against this. I mean, they pull their kids out of school during the Santa Claus celebration because the kids come home crying because other kids call them Black Pete.
It's so incredible. It's so racist. It's so incredible.
It's so racist. You know, the United Nations said that the Netherlands is basically in violation of the human rights agreement through this practice. So you have the United Nations, and politicians in the Netherlands some of them were calling to pull out of the United Nations rather than change Black Pete.
Wow. No, you, of course, are a filmmaker, and you're getting involved in this issue. And people didn't like that you were getting involved in this issue. Tell me what happened when people found out you're making a film about Black Pete.
Well, yes, I was filming and the press got word of it and they wrote an article and I got crazy amounts of hate mail. And it was interesting because the hate mail would start out saying, you know, this is an innocent children's holiday and this is our tradition and you have no right to come over here and interfere with that. And then they would end by calling me a stupid black monkey and telling me to eat a banana and go back to Africa.
Wow.
I'm like, well, I'm not from Africa. And I would get tweets and emails calling me the N-word. It got really ugly and really scary. And the last couple of screenings that I had to have security.
I was thinking there's a part, I think my favorite part of the film. Your neighbors invite you over to celebrate Christmas with their children and, of course, with Black Pete. And Black Pete shows up while you're there. What was that like for you?
You know, it was interesting because they are really nice people and really didn't realize how offensive Black Pete actually is for actual black people. And I must say, to their credit, since the film has come out, they sent me an email, and it was titled Love Mail.
And wow, they said, that's nice.
Our eyes are opened. We don't want to hurt or offend any person, and we will not celebrate. We will celebrate Santa Claus, but we will not include Black Pete as part of that celebration. And they invited me over to have dinner with them. And I think that what happened after the film is that I started getting less hate mail and more love mail. Mm. And people started to realize this is connected to slavery. This is offensive. And if even if one child is hurt, or even if a part of the population is hurt, we should change this practice so that it's inclusive of everyone. And that's amazing that actually, the power of film, that you could actually create change and start a conversation.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. What a great film, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you.
Academy Award-winning filmmaker Roger Ross Williams on his documentary Blackface. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And as you might have guessed, we're listening to a traditional Black Pete song in Dutch. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.